think inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sand or the strength of an oak with roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories hoard and to use them.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. Good morning, everybody. Coming now, Charles Seife. That's S-E-I-F-E, but pronounced Seife, I believe. Charles Seife is a writer for Science Magazine, where he covers physics and cosmology. He is the author of Zero, the biography of a dangerous idea, and Alpha and Omega, the search for the beginning and end of the universe. Prior to his involvement with science journalism, he was a mathematician. He received his undergraduate degree from Princeton, an MS from the Yale Mathematics Department. In addition, Charles attended Columbia Journalism School and is a member of the National Association of Science Writers. Charles Seife, in a moment. Now, I would normally never read a question for a guest before the guest, but I thought this was really good. It kind of sets it up. Gary writes, "Hey, Art, why are dimensions extra? Did the universe only come equipped with standard options when it was created? In other words, three dimensions? Also, what's the difference between extra dimensions and parallel universes? Is that where the time factor comes in? But then if we're talking physics, which we are, there is no time, right? The concept of an infinite universe could break your brain if you thought about it long enough. Again, time seems to rear its ugly head. You pick challenging topics to try and grasp, Gary." They are challenging topics, aren't they, Charles?
They are indeed. Lots of people have tried to wrap their heads around them and failed.
Yes, or ended up who knows where. Welcome to the program, Charles Seife.
Thank you for having me.
Am I pronouncing Seife correctly?
That is correct.
Wow. Well, all right then. I guess we'll plunge right in. I have as a regularly scheduled guest Professor Michio Kaku from the University of New York City. And he talks about the end of the universe, and I wonder if you're going to... The first question is how the universe is going to end, and I'm wondering if you're going to... tell us the same thing he does, or he believes.
I would expect so. About 10 years ago, if you asked either Dr. Kaku or any other physicist that question, they would have told you that there are two possibilities, more or less, for how the universe will end. Either the universe will expand for a while and get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then gravity will win out and collapse everything back into the ball, into the cosmic egg from which it came. It will be a big crunch, mm-hmm. an opposite of a big bang.
Mm-hmm. And for many years, they did think that to be true, right?
they thought that that was one of the two possibilities, and a lot of people thought that there was going to be a big crunch. In fact, I believe that Stephen Hawking was a believer in a big crunch.
Yeah, it's sort of like the rubber band theory. You keep stretching it and stretching it, and then you finally get out so far, and you can't handle it anymore, and boom.
Exactly, exactly. And then the other possibility was essentially that the rubber band breaks, that the universe keeps expanding and expanding, and the initial force of the explosion, the Big Bang, is enough to send the galaxies far away from each other. And it never, the universe never recollapses. Although gravity would slow that expansion over time, the expansion gets slower and slower.
Well, is that analogy still good? In other words, the broken band, a rubber band one, and then we just all go flinging out. There's some sort of magic switch point where the various gravitational attractions lose it, and phew, out you go?
Well, it looks like we are at one of those points where all of a sudden the universe is losing it.
Really?
Yes. In the past 7 years, scientists have come up with evidence for a mysterious anti-gravity force, dark energy.
Yes.
That is blowing the universe apart. And it looks we are living at precisely the moment where dark energy takes over, where it begins to dominate over gravity. And instead of slowing down this expansion, where the expansion gets tardier and tardier, it turns out that this dark energy is making the universe expand ever faster. It was a totally unexpected finding, just as unexpected as if you had tossed a ball into the air and found it zooming higher and higher into the sky rather than coming back to Earth.
This is very upsetting. The universe losing it, in effect. Just getting out there at the end of the stretch of the rubber band and, well...
Well, the universe ends either way. A big crunch. Everything would have to get hotter and hotter. The stars would come closer together, and the sky would glow hot at night, and that would be a death to life as surely as this ever increasing expansion, where everything gets colder and colder, and the stars wink out one by one.
That's the current general conventional wisdom, right? That it everything will. But there was something you said that really upset me. I was willing to accept the it'll get gradually colder and colder and colder and everything farther away until there's nothing left in the night sky except that very nearby us. Everything else gone. But that would be so far in the distant future. And what you said was kind of upsetting. We're at a moment where the universe might be losing it, or if it was kind of a special... See, I didn't think there was going to be like a throwing a switch kind of deal.
It's not so sudden. I mean, these changes take place over billions of years. But we are apparently at what's called an inflection point, where things do change. It's not like flicking a switch. Although there is a theory that came out in the past couple of years. I believe it was Mark Kaminkowski and a bunch of other physicists who came up with the idea of a big rip.
A big rip?
A big rip.
Doesn't sound good either.
That at some point it's possible that if dark energy has certain properties, it dominates so much that it tears everything apart. First galaxies fly apart, then solar systems fly apart, then planets, then the stars, and then even the atoms.
When you say fly apart,
they're held together by forces. Solar systems and galaxies are held together by gravity. Atoms are held together by what's called the strong force. But if dark energy grows stronger and stronger and stronger, the repulsive action of dark energy might be stronger than gravity and even the strong force.
So if we were living on Earth as this process of being ripped apart went on, what actually would we experience?
It would happen pretty suddenly, I think.
Really?
For a number of years, we'd probably see the sky get darker. As galaxies kind of disintegrate. And then within a matter of hours, I believe, I don't remember the exact time table.
Hours?
Hours. Stars disappear, planets disappear, and then atoms fall apart. It would be very sudden.
And then atoms fall apart?
Yes. Nothing left. So... Nothing left other than a soup of lifeless radiation.
So we would just sort of dematerialize. We would no longer exist. Our planet, everything on it, would just no longer exist?
That's correct. There would be nothing in the universe other than radiation. Of course, this depends upon, this is a theoretical construct at this point, and it depends upon the dark energy having a certain property that no one is quite sure whether it has or not. But speculation like that was unheard of just a decade ago because no one knew that this dark energy existed.
Well, is it worth asking how scientists know this? I mean, I get stories all the time. Like, here's one. I read it in the first hour of the program tonight.
Mm-hmm.
The massive West Antarctic ice sheet, previously assumed to be stable, mm-hmm. is starting to collapse, scientists warned on Tuesday. Now, that's the magic phrase, previously assumed to be stable. So all the time in science, you seem to get these sorts of stories where scientists, that's the way they all begin. And what it really means is, oops, we were wrong. Here's what's really going on.
Yes, well, science is always changing on some level. Part of the good thing about science is that bad theories get replaced by better ones and better ones as time goes on. And this story about dark energy seems fantastic. It seems just as fantastic as any myth out of Greece or Norse mythology.
Well, have we proven dark energy yet?
There are a number of actually direct consequences of dark energy that scientists have seen. The reason scientists believe in dark energy is they were led there by their nose. They didn't want to believe in it. In fact, it dropped out of one of Einstein's calculations. Before Edwin Hubble in the 1920s discovered that the universe was expanding, Einstein realized that his equations led to an unstable universe. It would either fly apart or collapse back. So to fix the universe, to make it stable, he added this cosmological constant, an extra term, a fudge factor, to stop this instability. It turns out when Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding, Einstein said, oh, what was I thinking? That was a mistake. And for decades, scientists saw this the idea of a cosmological constant, this anti-gravity force.
But wait, Einstein wasn't alive when Hubble discovered that.
Yes, he was, actually.
He was?
Yes, it was, Hubble discovered this stuff in the 1920s.
Not the
Hubble Space Telescope. Edwin Hubble, the astronomer.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. I was still with the soon-to-be deorbited Hubble.
That's right. Yeah, Einstein had died by the time Hubble went up.
At least.
But this is the astronomer, the eponymous astronomer whom the Hubble Space Telescope
that Hubble, after. Thank you. Okay.
And in the 1920s, he did some nice observations that showed that the universe was expanding. And so Einstein tried to fix his equations and realized he had made a mistake. And since then, no one figured that there would be an anti-gravity force until the late 90s, 97, 98, when scientists began to be led there despite themselves. There were some
by what?
By observations of distant exploding stars known as supernovae. These supernovae are of known brightness. They're what are called a standard candle.
Right.
And by looking at these supernovae at various distances, you can measure how fast the universe is expanding. And since looking at great distance in astronomy is the same as looking very far back in time, because light takes a certain amount of time to reach us, something that is 13 billion light years away will take 13 billion years for that light to reach us. That's a long way of saying the further something is away, the further back in time you're looking.
You're looking back 13 billion years or something
right.
like that. Yes, okay.
But
it also means that light emitter 13 billion years ago might now be dead as a doornail, and we might not know that for 11 billion more years or something.
That's absolutely correct. Much of what scientists are looking at in the universe is long since ceased to exist.
Then doesn't that to some degree put a caution in what they have to say?
Absolutely. They don't know for sure that the early universe had the same laws, the same properties that our modern universe did. In fact, you look back and in very distant galaxies, they have slightly different properties. You have to take that into account. So, of course, that is a caution, but actually they're very, very good at this. And the supernovae are a very nice check on that because it's a single star. It seems to have the same properties at all eras. And when you see it explode at different periods back in time, you can measure how fast the universe was expanding at different periods of time. So by looking at these supernovae, you get kind of a gauge of how fast the universe is expanding.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, by looking at these supernovae, scientists found out that the universe is expanding faster and faster and faster. And the only way that that would make sense is if Einstein's cosmological constant or some other anti-gravity force were blowing up the universe faster and faster. Now, when this evidence was first shown, I mean, everyone took notice and thought, this is very interesting, but it didn't convince a lot of people because it's a fantastic story. But since then, a number of other lines of evidence have come up, like the cosmic background radiation, the soup of radiation that streamed forth when the universe was only 400,000 years old. By looking at shapes in the cosmic background radiation, scientists have shown that there really has to be a dark energy.
Okay.
In fact, they saw a distortion in this energy called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. It's just an extra wiggle in this radiation that can only be caused by dark energy. So it really looks like there's something there.
Well, they call it dark energy, and I guess that's all right. But and I guess they've proven fairly well that there is a force there, and I guess dark energy is as good a name as any, but it still means unknown energy, right?
That's correct. There's only a few ideas about what could be causing this energy, but it is pretty much the biggest mystery in physics today. What is this dark energy? What is causing it?
What are the best guesses about what causes it? I'm curious about that.
Many of your fans would probably be familiar with the term zero-point energy.
Oh, they would.
For those who aren't familiar, zero-point energy has to do with the fact that at every point in space, even in the deepest vacuum, particles and antiparticles are being created and destroyed. And if you set up an experiment in the right way, you can actually cause those particles to move things around. In 1996, experimenters at the University of Washington showed that this zero-point energy, this force of nothing, essentially, could move metal plates.
That's really a misnomer, though. It's not a force of nothing, is it? There can't be a force of nothing.
Well, it's a force. You can't get rid of it. It's even in the deepest vacuum, you pump out every particle in a box.
Yes.
The zero-point energy will still be there. It's because these particles are constantly being created and destroyed. Even though these particles exist on some sense, they don't exist on another sense. They're almost like a bookkeeping trick that the nature uses to keep her books in order.
Hmm.
And yet, they have this measurable effect. It could be that dark energy is caused by some sort of zero-point energy.
That would be matter and antimatter colliding?
On some level, yes. It's matter and antimatter created, energy being created and being destroyed in the vacuum. And because of this energy in every point in space, it causes the very fabric of space-time to expand. The problem is, if you do the raw calculations just from straight theory and figure out how much force the zero-point energy would create, it's way, way, way too much.
It's way too much?
Way too much. Something has to be reigning in the zero-point energy. And no one quite knows what is going wrong with those calculations.
Huh. So there's an energy out there that's really an energy of nothingness, at least from our current perspective, it's nothingness.
That's correct.
But it's a monstrous force.
It is absolutely monstrous. In a tiny little box in your toast, as something the size of your toaster, in theory, there is more energy than all the nuclear arsenals in the world. Of course, it's not so easy to harness this. In fact, it doesn't look like that is an energy that can be harnessed, even in theory.
Well, if it can be done, I'm sure our military will figure out some way to do it.
Let's hope they're not the first.
Aren't they usually?
well, yes, actually. They've got the most incentive.
Yes, yes. A force of that magnitude that could be harnessed in a little box, toaster-type box, really does make quite a deterrent. And that's being kind.
Yes, but luckily, I mean, nature seems to be protecting that zero-point energy.
So far.
So far. And most likely, in the indefinite future, every single way you can think of to harness that energy, for instance, you move these plates together,
mm-hmm.
you can make that run a generator. However, you have to expend energy to pull those plates apart again. So to get a motor running, you have to have a cycle. And the zero-point energy doesn't seem to be amenable to cycles.
Well, Charles, I was just talking about this, too, in the first hour. Inevitably, people come and talk to me about over-unity devices. I've been doing the show now for probably going on 15 years, and I have received calls and emails and diagrams and descriptions and claims about free energy and over-unity devices, and in all of those years, beg though I have, nobody has sent me so much as even a toy, even a little demonstrative toy that uses more energy, or creates more energy than it uses in its function. Have you seen one?
No, I have not.
You haven't either?
Nope. Neither has the patent office.
Oh, and the patent office hasn't either?
Nope.
Gee, now there's some people who would probably argue with that, and they'll send all kinds of... have you examined all the patents claiming?
I have looked at some of them, yes.
And not a one?
Not a one. There's a couple of claims that they say they do, but they don't have working devices.
Hold it right there, Charles. In the nighttime, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
We're doomed. I always knew it. We're doomed. Absolutely. One day we're going to wake up and we're not going to wake up. One day, everything, us, the planet, the trees, the birds, everything, like that, gone. Just like it was never here. Huh. That's something to try and wrap your mind around, the way it may end one day when dark energy makes its final snappy push. And that's it, baby. We're gone.
Ever wonder who...
Charles Seif is my guest, well-credentialed indeed to be speaking of these matters, and inevitably you get this kind of response. Here is something from my computer, directly from my computer. From Milton in Columbia, South Carolina. Art, ask him about Tom Bearden's patents, 803-331-8059. Charles, Have you examined the patents of Tom Bearden and some others?
The name rings a bell, and I think I did a number of years ago. I think he was one of the people who was attending this controversial DOE conference a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say I remember that patent in particular.
But generally, you've studied these patents and find...
Yes, that they usually have a flaw, that they will make claims, and nominally, the patent office has a rule that if you have a over-unity device, you have to provide a working model.
I like that.
But it seems not to have been followed strictly all the time, and a couple slip in.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's like you, I'll believe it when I see it. And there's some pretty powerful physical laws that say it's not going to happen.
Yes, there are. And there are also psychological forces at work. I mean, if you rest on the belief that science will, I don't know, come along and save us from our oil-using ways, why, then you might be tempted to just lie back and wait for science to save our butts, and in the meantime, keep on pumping those barrels.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's lots of money involved. There's also psychological barriers. Whenever you're a scientist, you think of something and you think you have a great idea. You're lying back in bed at night, and it may take you a while to figure out that there's a flaw in your thinking. And once in a while, some scientists will be unable to back down when they've got this apparently great idea, unable to see the flaw that's staring them in the face.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's quite a number of people who are genuinely believe that they have some sort of idea or device, but just don't see why it fails.
Well, I'm kind of sorry it's been going on for the reasons that I stated, because it does cause people to sort of lie back on their laurels and not worry about it, thinking science will save them. And, well, it might, but, I don't think I'd go to the bank on that. You're here to answer some of these questions, like, for example, the Big Bang. Why are scientists so confident it happened at all, that there ever was a... How do we know there was a Big Bang? None of us were here.
Mm-hmm.
And the story I get is something smaller than even a quark, or the size of a quark, at least, or smaller, became all that we now know, all the planets, all the suns, everything. That's so incredible to try and even imagine that. Isn't it somewhat arrogant to even say we know what happened?
Yes. You've got the scenario just right. The universe, most scientists believe that the universe started as some sort of seed smaller than anything we know. And everything in the universe came from that seed. But that was not the only scenario a number of years ago. When scientists found out that the universe was expanding, they thought long and hard and came up with a couple of scenarios that made sense. One was the Big Bang, that everything came from a point, and that's why everything's expanding out.
Yes.
The other key contender was something called steady-state theory, where perhaps there's some sort of fountain that creates matter in the center of the universe, and it spreads out, making the universe ever bigger. But as things age and die towards the end, they fade out. So as a whole, the universe doesn't change, even though the stars and galaxies start in the center, move out, and die. As a whole, the universe looks pretty much the same.
Well, again, the Big Bang.
The reason Big Bang has so much power is when people analyze the Big Bang scenario, they went to their blackboards and did some calculations and said, if there was a Big Bang, it had to be very hot. And if it was very hot, there has to be this remnant radiation floating around everywhere in the universe.
Right.
That should be around, 10 degrees Kelvin or below.
Okay.
And when they looked in their telescopes and looked for that radiation, and there it was. It was everywhere. So that was nice. And then they said, there are stars and galaxies. This is not completely uniform radiation. Even though our telescopes are not sensitive enough to see splotches in this radiation, they should be there. It took 20 more years, But when they got the equipment there, they looked, and sure enough, there were these splotches.
What do the splotches mean?
The splotches are remnants of the time when the universe was extremely small, and the zero-point energy, in a sense, had its mark on the cosmos. That these quantum fluctuations made the universe not completely smooth. It was bumpy. There were places where there was more density and less density. And as the universe expanded extremely rapidly in a phase now called inflation, those overdense and underdense sections became spread out and got very, very large. And places where there was a lot of density became galaxies, and places where there were underdensities became voids. And sure enough, when they had the sensitivity to look, they saw these overdense and underdense regions in the cosmic background radiation, which seemed to correspond extremely well with the distribution of galaxies and voids that we see today. So it made this nice prediction, and the prediction was verified. And every time there's a very concrete prediction, that prediction is verified. So it's a very nice marker that you're headed in the right direction.
Huh. So this verifies that the energy that would be expected of a Big Bang, or the remnant energy of a Big Bang, and the details associated with it, all are there, saying, yes, there was a Big Bang.
Yes, to great, great accuracy. It's stunning, actually, to, I mean, I have a mathematical background, and I when I look at a graph of what is predicted by these Big Bang models, and I look at the data, and the match is beautiful. It is really a very nice, clear indication that they're onto something. Even if they're wrong on some level, maybe there wasn't a Big Bang, but whatever happened has to look very much like a Big Bang.
Let me try and see if I'm grasping this. Prior to the Big Bang, there was nothing but dark energy?
Prior to the Big Bang, well, physics doesn't really reach that far, although there are some theories. You can actually get down to the first few microseconds after the Big Bang. Physicists know pretty well how physics works up to the just very, very millionths of a second after the Big Bang. But go beyond that, and physics breaks down. And the laws don't really give you much traction. So you go to the point of the Big Bang, and everything breaks down. You have to just guess. And there are a number of good guesses. One guess is that there was nothing at all.
Of
a sudden, it just...
Nobody can grasp that.
Yeah,
there cannot be nothing.
Well,
that in itself is something.
In some sense, of course, especially in our vacuum with the zero-point fluctuations. Things are being created and destroyed. It could be that the universe is just a really big zero-point fluctuation.
Mm-hmm. One time somebody said something I thought was very elegant. They said that God was lonely, and so God blew himself up. You know how many people say, you know, we are God.
Mm-hmm.
God is part of us all. God is everywhere. You know, that fits in kind of elegantly into that. I mean, God blew himself up, and he was lonely.
And we are certainly all part of this thing that was much smaller than any of us, much smaller than any of the particles in our body.
And once you get back to this Big Bang, and you start, as you your word, guessing, this is as good a guess as any.
Yes. And there's some other guesses also, actually.
Yes. Like what?
In the past few years, there's something called the ekpyrotic theory.
Then that would be?
That is... somewhat similar to the Big Bang, but instead you have this pre-existing parallel universe.
Parallel universe.
Yes, that you have these two membranes floating somewhat near each other, and they periodically smack into each other and separate, and smack into each other and separate. And every time they smack into each other, you get a Big Bang, essentially. And it seems kind of silly on some level, but the mathematics behind it is based in the successor to string theory called M-theory. It was really the first M-theoretic description of the birth of the universe, and a number of scientists, including Paul Steinhardt at Princeton.
So you're suggesting two bubbles floating in space. I mean, you've got to get this in your mind. And occasionally these bubbles bump into each other, these dimensions.
Right.
And when that occurs, there's a Big Bang. Now, there have been recent announcements by science that they have discovered energies equivalent to perhaps the Big Bang, these sudden onrushes of energy that are recorded that are near Big Bang strength. You've heard about those, I presume.
There's several candidates. There's gamma ray bursts, which are the most energetic explosions in the universe.
Yes.
There's also ultra-high energy cosmic rays, where you have a single particle which has, in its when it smacks into something, it's almost like a little Big Bang. Were you referring to gamma ray bursts?
Yes.
Okay.
Gigantic gamma ray bursts that detected.
They're absolutely huge. They are, let's see, a supernova is what, in terms of energy, it's 10 to the 51 ergs. Let's see how to describe that. It's just so far beyond anything earthly. It's unbelievable. A supernova outshines the rest of its galaxy, all the stars in the galaxy. A gamma ray burst is even more energetic than that. But even that energy is nothing compared to the Big Bang.
Are we talking, perhaps, by the way, about the collision of black holes producing gamma ray bursts of that sort, or what are the best guesses?
That's a very good guess. Or the creation of black holes in some fashion. It has to be an extraordinarily energetic event, and the collapse of matter into a black hole is energetic. All of a sudden, the star collapses, sets the universe rippling. It creates gravitational waves that ripple throughout the universe. In fact, mm-hmm. a spacecraft that should go up sometime next decade, if the budgets go right, would be able to detect that sort of collision. And at the same time, it releases gamma radiation, X-rays, that are so bright they can be seen from half a universe away.
So, again, prior to the Big Bang, you're suggesting one alternative is there was nothing, hard as that is to grasp.
Yes.
And the other?
And the other was that you have these pre-existing world sheets, membranes, smacking into each other. That's the ekpyrotic universe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then we go back to this, I think I read it just before you came on, this thing where Gary asks, why are dimensions extra? Did the universe only come equipped with standard options when it was created? In other words, three dimensions?
Well, if you look around your room, you can stick your arm out in three mutually exclusive directions. You can stick
Indeed.
It out front, back, left, right, or up, down. And so
yes.
If an ordinary human being, if you left to his own devices, you ask him how many dimensions there are, there's three. But mathematically, if you look at it a little more carefully, as Einstein did, he realized that time was not separable from these three dimensions. That when you affect your movement through those three dimensions, you also affect your movement through time.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, time is the fourth dimension. And scientists call this the 3+1 universe because it has slightly different properties. That's an extra dimension in a sense because people don't think of it like the ordinary three dimensions. You have to intellectually get your head around it in a way that you don't have to with other three dimensions.
So you're moving your arm around the room, the air, the adjacent objects, everything you can see, all three dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
But you're actually also moving it through the fourth dimension, time. As you
correct.
Move your arm from here to there, you have used time.
That's correct. And, in fact, you might be moving it through more dimensions. One of the key theories that physicists are kicking around right now, string theory and M theory, require 10 or 11 dimensions for these things to work out. They believe that on some level you have other dimensions that are really not accessible to us. It's these dimensions are curled up very small, so it's beyond even our best microscopes or best particle accelerators to detect. But as you move your arm, you're also moving through these extra 7 or 8 dimensions.
Hmm.
It's hard to grasp, but mathematically it makes sense. In fact, mathematicians have no problems with infinite dimensions. Hilbert space, which is a space crucial to quantum mechanics, is an infinite dimensional space. And mathematicians work with it all the time. They don't think about it very much.
Otherwise, they'd go bananas, totally bananas. You can't grasp the infinite. you just truly, and I guess a mathematician can work with it and know that something's, you know, going to go on calculating this virtually forever.
Yes.
But, no, you can't. Before they exclaim that, yeah, that's so, they should try grasping even the concept of the eternity. I mean, you can't really do it.
It's very, very difficult. Mathematicians have some angles in. They have some ways of controlling infinities. And they, in fact, have theories of infinities. Around the turn of the century, a German mathematician, George Cantor, showed that there are different levels of infinity, which in itself is totally baffling.
It almost sounds ridiculous. Different levels of infinity. How could that possibly be? The moment you get to a level of infinity, that's it.
Well, there are, in fact, infinities bigger than other infinities, bigger than other infinities, and there's an infinity of infinities. He mathematically proved it. This is incontrovertible fact. So long as you believe the axioms of mathematics, this is true. It's the difference between the number line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the natural numbers. That's one level of infinity. All those numbers are infinite. But if you take the full real line, all the decimal numbers, all the irrational numbers, pi, square root of 2, add those, mm-hmm. That's a higher level of infinity than just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's really hard to grasp, but it's all true. And once you've worked with it for a while, it's almost as if there's no other way it could be. It makes perfect sense. And in fact,
it makes perfect sense. So you're saying a mathematician can get so comfortable with the concept that, as you put it, it makes perfect sense, because it certainly doesn't to me.
Yes, it's actually not too difficult. It's you just need a few minutes with someone who's a mathematician who's willing to train you, and then you can start grasping infinity, and a whole new world opens up. It's like exploring a new land. I try to do that a little bit in my book, Zero. I do discuss the different levels of infinity.
Yeah, good book title, Exploring Infinity.
Yes, and there was last year, I think, David Foster Wallace, the famed novelist, wrote a book about infinity also. There's lots of people who are very interested in it, and scientists are interested in it too, because infinities crop up in their equations all the time. It usually causes problems.
Well, I suppose if they stop to actually think about it, which you're suggesting they really don't. They just accept the numbers, and they become satisfied from the math angle, and they don't contemplate the other problems associated with it. Hold on, Charles. We're at the top of the hour. Charles Seif is my guest, and we're talking about things that, well, it's a little difficult to get your mind wrapped around some of them, like infinity. During the break, let's have everybody think as much as they're able about infinity. Something with no end, ever, unlike our universe apparently, which, well, could be at a turning point.